You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity.
Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are really getting into the heart of things, literally. We're focusing on the cardiomyocyte, that single amazing cell that basically dictates everything we do in the OR.
It absolutely does.
We're thinking of them as maybe the power plants generating energy, but also the orchestras keeping everything in sync.
That's a good way to put it. And, you know, for anyone in perioperative care, this is fundamental. Every single thing we do, every drug, every monitor reading, it all comes back to this one cell type.
Okay, but here's something that might surprise people listening.
Yeah, the heart relies entirely on these cardiomyocytes for contraction, but they actually make up less than a third of all the cells in the heart.
Less than a third. So it's not just a big lump of muscle.
Not at all. No, most of it is actually support structure.
Yeah.
You've got endothelial cells, lining vessels, fibroblasts providing scaffolding, immune cells, all the background stuff. But that critical one-third doing the actual work, that's where the vulnerability lies. And that's our mission today, really, to understand why the nitty-gritty molecular physiology of these contractile cells is just, well, non-negotiable for us. Our anesthetics, they aren't just general suppressants. They directly, or sometimes indirectly, mess with ion channels, calcium handling, energy production.
You can't just wing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Ignoring that cellular reality. That leads to poor drug choices, maybe unsafe monitoring, and ultimately it risks patient safety. We need to be informed.
Okay, let's unpack that vulnerability then, starting with the basics, the actual structure, the blueprint of a cardiomyocyte. What makes it so special structurally?
Well, a few key things stand out. They typically have just one centrally located nucleus, unlike skeletal muscle. And crucially, they are absolutely stuffed with mitochondria.
You mentioned that the power plants.
Yeah, we're talking about maybe 30% of the entire cell volume is just mitochondria. It tells you how incredibly high their energy demand is. They're constantly working.
Constantly.
Then there's the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the SR. It's this extensive internal network, basically a specialized storage tank for calcium, which is key for contraction.
And the connections between cells.
Ah, yes, the intercalated discs. Critically important. These are complex junctions that physically link the cells end to end.
I always picture them like electrical and mechanical Velcro holding everything together and passing the signal along, like a handshake circuit.
That's a perfect analogy. They ensure that electrical signal spreads instantly from cell to cell, and they provide the mechanical strength so the tissue doesn't tear apart during forceful contractions. It's all about coordination.
Okay, structure dictates function and vulnerability. How does this connect directly to patients we see with heart disease, say dilated cardiomyopathy or ischemic heart disease?
Right, well, in those patients, the cardiomyocyte biology is already compromised. They often have fewer functioning cells. The ones they do have might be hypertrophied or damaged. Their calcium handling is often impaired. And those dense mitochondria. They might already be struggling, running low on ATP reserves, even at baseline.
So they're starting off with a disadvantage. Their cellular machinery is already strained.
Precisely. They have less physiological reserve.
So if they're already running on, let's say, low battery, how does that play out immediately when we give our anesthetic drugs?
It makes them incredibly sensitive.
Yeah.
Take a common scenario. Inducing a patient who has significant heart failure. You give a standard dose of, say, propofol.
Yeah.
That patient is uniquely prone to developing profound, rapid hypotension, much more so than a patient with a healthy heart.
Why propofol specifically in that case?
Because propofol hits multiple systems, vasodilation, direct myocardial depression. You're pushing a system that's already struggling with low ATP, maybe poor calcium cycling. You're pushing it closer to the edge. We're often operating right on that margin of cardiovascular stability.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's dig deeper into those systems, the electrical and mechanical parts, the switches and conductors, as you put it. Let's start with the electrical switches, the ion channels in the cell membrane, the sarcolemma.
Right. The sarcolemma is where the action potential happens. It's all about controlling the flow of ions. You need that super fast upstroke, phase zero depolarization. That's driven mainly by the NaV1.5 voltage-gated sodium channels snapping open.
Just sodium in.
Exactly. Then you get the plateau phase. Phase two, which is characteristic of cardiac cells, that relies heavily on the influx of calcium through CaV1.2 L-type calcium channels. That calcium influx is also the trigger for contraction.
Okay, sodium in, calcium in. Then how does it reset?
That's repolarization, bringing the membrane potential back down. That involves various potassium channels opening, letting potassium flow out. Key players here include channels like KATP-AKE, the ATP-sensitive ones, and the HA channels, which are crucial for finishing repolarization.
And we, as clinicians, directly target these channels all the time, don't we?
Constantly. Think about it. We use lidocaine to block those NaV1.5 channels, specifically to treat ventricular tachycardia. That's a direct channel intervention.
Right, slowing down that rapid firing. But you mentioned KTP channels. Is there a beneficial interaction there with our drugs?
Yes, this is fascinating. The volatile anesthetics like sevoflurane or isoflurane actually activate KETP channels.
Activate them? What does that do?
Well, these channels normally open when cellular ATP levels fall, like during ischemia. Opening them helps stabilize the cell membrane and conserve energy. So when volatiles open them, it sort of mimics the early stages of ischemic preconditioning.
So using a volatile might actually offer some heart protection, especially during high-risk surgery like a bypass.
That's the idea, and there's good evidence supporting it. It's a potential way our anesthetic choice can pre-arm the heart against upcoming stress, like reperfusion injury.
That's pretty cool. But messing with repolarization, you mentioned ERG channels. Is there a downside there? Can we cause problems?
Oh, definitely. The ERG channel, or KVO11.1, is critical for that final phase of repolarization. If you block it, you prolong the QT interval on the ECG.
Which is bad.
Which can be very bad. Certain drugs, including some high-dose opioids, can inhibit ERG channels. In a patient who's already susceptible, this QT prolongation significantly increases the risk of developing torsades de pointe.
That polymorphic VT.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Exactly. A potentially fatal arrhythmia. So knowing channel effects is crucial.
Okay, that covers the electrical switches. Now let's move to the mechanical conductor system, how that electrical signal makes the muscle actually squeeze. Excitation contraction coupling, ECC.
Right. ECC is the core process. That initial electrical spark, the action potential, causes that small influx of calcium through the L-type channels we just talked about.
The CAV1.2 channels.
Yes, but that initial trickle of calcium isn't enough to cause a full contraction. Its main job is to act as a trigger. It binds to receptors on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the SR.
Your calcium store.
Exactly. Specifically, it binds to the rhinodine receptors, or RIR2, on the SR membrane. This triggers a massive release of calcium from the SR into the cytoplasm. It's called calcium-induced calcium release.
So a little calcium coming in triggers a huge flood from storage.
Precisely. And that big surge of intracellular calcium binds to the contractile protein, troponin C, and initiates the cross-bridge cycling, the actual muscle contraction, the squeeze.
Got it. Squeeze achieved. But the heart needs to relax to fill again. How does all that calcium get put away?
Relaxation or diastole. Equally critical, and often where things go wrong in heart failure. The FEL needs to rapidly lower that intracellular calcium concentration. The main player here is the Circadipua. Circatuer, yeah. It's an ATPase pump located on the SR membrane that actively pumps calcium back into the SR using ATP energy.
So it vacuums the calcium back up?
Essentially, yes. But there's a built-in regulator, a protein called phospholamban, or PLB. Under baseline conditions, PLB kind of puts the brakes on Circatua, inhibiting its activity.
A brake? Why have a brake?
It allows for modulation. When the heart needs to pump harder or faster, like during exercise or with beta adrenergic stimulation, PLB gets phosphorylated. That phosphorylation relieves the inhibition. It takes the foot off the brake, allowing Circatua to work faster, suck up calcium quicker, and thus speed up relaxation.
Okay, so phosphorylation speeds up relaxation by removing the brake on the calcium vacuum cleaner.
You got it. Now think about heart failure again.
Right.
In many forms of heart failure, Circatua function is defective, or there's less of it, or the PLB regulation is messed up. The result, calcium isn't cleared efficiently from the cytoplasm.
So the cell stays contracted longer.
Or relaxes more slowly and incompletely. You get prolonged calcium transients and impaired diastolic relaxation. The ventricle becomes stiff, it struggles to fill properly.
Which explains diastolic dysfunction, even if the squeeze, the ejection fraction, seems okay.
Exactly. And that's the cellular rationale for using a drug like milrinone, especially post-cardiopulmonary bypass. Milrinone, a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, increases cyclic AMP levels, which leads to more PLB phosphorylation.
Taking the foot off the brake.
Taking the foot off the brake, enhancing Circatua activity, improving calcium reuptake, and thus promoting better relaxation and diastolic function. It directly targets that impaired calcium handling.
That connection is really clear. Okay, let's shift gears to the power plants, the mitochondria. We know they're dense. What fuel are they burning primarily?
Under normal aerobic conditions, the heart is an omnivore, but it strongly prefers fatty acids. They account for maybe 60-70% of its ATP production. Glucose, lactate, ketones make up the rest.
So optimized for fat burning.
Very much so. They have incredible oxidative capacity. But this heavy reliance on mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation makes them vulnerable if that process gets poisoned.
Which brings us back to something you mentioned earlier, propofol infusion syndrome, pre-IIS. That's a direct mitochondrial hit, right?
It's the classic and terrifying example of anesthetic-induced mitochondrial toxicity. Propofol, especially in high doses or over long periods, is known to inhibit complex I of the mitochondrial electron transport chain.
Complex I, so right at the start of the main energy pathway.
Exactly. Blocking complex I disrupts the whole chain, drastically reducing ATP production and leading to a buildup of upstream metabolites. The clinical picture is devastating. Profound refractory metabolic acidosis, rhabdomyolysis from muscle breakdown, hyperkalemia, arrhythmias, and ultimately cardiovascular collapse.
Truly catastrophic. A failure of the cell's core energy system.
Absolutely. And it highlights why we need to be so cautious with prolonged high-dose propofol, especially in patients with risk factors like critical illness or poor nutrition. We also need to remember that even routine things like hypothermia during cardiopulmonary bypass naturally slow down mitochondrial metabolism and ATP generation.
Right. So hypothermia itself reduces energy production.
Yes. Which means we need to adjust our anesthetic doses downwards, anticipating that slower cellular metabolism and reduced drug clearance.
Okay. We've covered power, electrical signals, calcium handling. What about the physical connections keeping it all together and synchronize those intercalated disks?
Right, back to the handshake circuits. They're crucial. They have two main components performing distinct jobs. First, the gap junctions.
For electrical connection.
Precisely. These are channels formed by proteins called connexins, mainly connexin 43 in the ventricles. They allow ions and small molecules to pass directly from one cell cytoplasm to the next, ensuring that the wave of depolarization spreads almost instantaneously across the myocardium. Synchronized contraction.
And the second part.
Mechanical adhesion. This is provided by structures called desmosomes. Think of them as molecular rivets or spot welds. They strongly anchor the cell membranes together, preventing the cells from pulling apart during the powerful contractions.
So electrical sync via gap junctions, mechanical strength via desmosomes?
Got it. Both are essential for normal function.
And when these connections fail, what kind of pathology do we see?
Well, a really striking example is arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, or ARVC. This is a genetic condition often caused by mutations in the genes encoding desmosomal proteins.
So the rivets are faulty.
Exactly. The connections are weak. Over time, myocytes in the right ventricle especially can detach, die, and get replaced by fatty and fibrous tissue. This creates areas of slow conduction and reentry circuits.
Leading to arrhythmias.
Life-threatening ventricular arrhythmias. For us managing an ARVC patient, the implications are huge. They're incredibly sensitive to adrenergic surges. Catecholamines can trigger arrhythmias. We need meticulous electrolyte management, especially potassium and magnesium. And we absolutely must avoid drugs that prolong the QT interval because that further increases arrhythmia risk. We're basically managing a structurally and electrically fragile heart.
That makes sense. Okay, let's try to apply the cellular knowledge more broadly now. Thinking about the most common side effect we manage, anesthetic-induced myocardial depression. How does our cellular understanding explain that?
At its core, most anesthetic-induced myocardial depression comes down to interfering with excitation-contraction coupling, depressed ECC.
Less efficient coupling of the electrical signal to the mechanical squeeze.
Exactly. Agents like propofol and the volatile anesthetics can reduce the sensitivity of the contractile proteins to calcium. And importantly, they often reduce the amount of calcium released from the SR or entering through the L-type channels.
So less trigger calcium, maybe less release, makes the squeeze weaker?
Correct. And this effect is obviously much more pronounced in a patient who already has impaired contractility, someone with a low ejection fraction, EF, to begin with. Their system has less reserve, so the depressant effect of the anesthetic is magnified.
Weaker cell, weaker heart.
It follows directly.
What about metabolic stress? You mentioned the heart prefers fatty acids but can be flexible. How does that play out during surgery?
Well, the healthy heart is remarkably adaptable. It has sensing systems like AMPK, which detects low energy states, low ATP-AMP ratio, and can trigger switches to utilize glucose more efficiently if needed. In hypoxia, another factor called HIF-1 gets stabilized and promotes a shift toward glycolysis.
So it can switch fuels when necessary.
Yes, that's metabolic flexibility. But here's the catch. Patients with conditions like diabetes or obesity often exhibit metabolic inflexibility. Their cells might be stuck preferentially burning one fuel source, often fats, and they struggle to adapt efficiently when faced with stress, like surgical trauma, hypoxia, or ischemia.
So they handle the metabolic challenges of surgery poorly.
Much more poorly. Their cardiomyocytes can't adapt as well, potentially leading to faster energy depletion dysfunction during periods of high demand or low supply.
Okay, let's try to quickly connect the dots for some core drugs we use every day, summarizing their main cellular targets based on what we've discussed. Volatiles first.
Okay, volatiles. Potential cardioprotection, as we said, via KATP channel activation, that's a plus. But they can also reduce L-type calcium channel current, potentially worsening diastolic dysfunction by impairing relaxation in susceptible patients. So, a double-edged sword.
Ketamine, very different profile.
Totally different. Ketamine primarily works via indirect sympathomimetic effects, releasing norepinephrine, leading to beta-adrenergic stimulation. This increases heart rate contractility and, crucially, myocardial oxygen demand. Great in trauma or hypovolemia where you need that boost.
But potentially bad.
Potentially disastrous in a patient with active coronary ischemia, where increasing oxygen demand is the last thing you want.
Propofol.
Main concerns. Vasodilation, myocardial depression via reduced calcium sensitivity availability, and that big one, mitochondrial complex I inhibition, risking with prolonged or high-dose use.
And dexmedetomidine, alpha-2 agonist.
Dexmedetomidine primarily acts centrally to reduce sympathetic outflow. Peripherally, it also slows SA node firing, likely through effects on HCN channels, the funny current. This is great for blunting catecholamine surges, like during intubation or emergence.
But the risk is
bradycardia and hypotension, especially if the patient is hypovolemic or heavily reliant on sympathetic tone, needs careful titration.
That cellular understanding really should guide our intraoperative strategy then. Can you give a couple of quick examples, like clinical vignettes, where this knowledge changes management?
Absolutely. Let's take that ischemic preconditioning idea. Imagine your 65-year-old patient, EF of 30%, coming for a CABG. Knowing that sevoflurane activates KATP channels, you might specifically choose to use it, maybe even give a small bolus just before aortic cross-clamping, consciously trying to leverage that protective effect against the upcoming ischemia reperfusion hit.
Actively using the cellular mechanism.
It's exactly. Or consider chronic beta blocker therapy. We know these drugs protect the heart by reducing chronic catecholamine stress and oxygen demand. So continuing them perioperatively is standard practice to blunt ischemia risk.
But requires vigilance.
Right, because you're also blunting the patient's ability to respond to hypotension with tachycardia. So you need to be extra watchful for bradycardia and have your pacing and chronotropes ready. Another example, extubating a high-risk patient with ischemic heart disease.
Yeah.
A big sympathetic surge, then, could be dangerous.
Tachycardia, hypertension, increased MVO2.
Precisely. So using a dexmedetomidine infusion during emergence is a targeted strategy. You're using its specific mechanism, reducing sympathetic outflow, slowing the SA node to deliberately prevent that dangerous catecholamine spike.
It makes sense. And how does this cellular dysfunction translate directly to what we see on our monitors?
It's a direct correlation. If ECCs are depressed, say, by too much volatile or propofol in a sensitive heart, you'll see it immediately as low blood pressure, low cardiac output, maybe a drop in SVO2 on the PA catheter.
The bedside signs of cellular weakness.
Exactly. And the action is logical. Reduce the anesthetic concentration, consider adding an inotrope to boost calcium cycling or sensitivity. If you see ischemic changes on the ECG-ST depression, T-wave inversion, that's a direct signal of cellular oxygen supply demand mismatch.
I'm telling you the cells are starving.
Yes. The response, optimize hemodynamics, improve blood pressure, maybe reduce heart rate if it's too fast, and maximize oxygen delivery, FiO2, hemoglobin, and that potential mitochondrial issue with propofol.
How might that show up?
You might see unexpectedly deep BIS suppression for the clinical level of sedation, combined with refractory hypotension that doesn't respond well to typical vasopressors. It's a clue that the core energy system might be failing. The action. Reduce or stop the propofol, switch agents, maybe consider specific metabolic support if PROVIS is suspected.
And if things go really wrong, intraoperative cardiac arrest. How does cell physiology inform our resuscitation?
It's fundamental. Epinephrine is first line because it hits alpha and beta receptors, boosting contractility, beta-1, more calcium, and vasoconstriction, alpha-1. Vasopressin is key in refractory VF pulseless VT, especially when adrenergic receptors might be downregulated or saturated. It works via V1 receptors, causing vasoconstriction independent of adrenergic pathways.
What about calcium chloride? People used to give it more often.
Yeah, but routine use isn't recommended. Calcium overload can actually worsen outcomes, causing hypercontracture and impairing relaxation. We reserve it for very specific situations where there's a clear reason for a calcium deficiency or malfunction documented hypocalcemia, massive transfusion with citrate toxicity chelating calcium, hyperkalemia causing membrane instability, or a calcium channel blocker overdose, not just as a general inotrope.
And antiarrhythmics.
For refractory VFPVT, amiodarone is the primary drug. It has complex actions, blocking multiple channels, sodium, potassium, calcium, and beta receptors, helping to stabilize the membrane and terminate reentry circuits. Lidocaine is an alternative, specifically targeting those fast sodium channels.
Okay, so the OR part is done, surgery's over, but the cellular challenges aren't finished, right? The journey continues post-op.
Absolutely, a critical point. The perioperative period is a continuum. Postoperatively, cardiomyocytes face a whole new set of challenges. Reperfusion injury after bypass, myocardial stunning, ongoing inflammation, significant metabolic shifts. The stress doesn't just stop when the drapes come down.
Let's talk about reperfusion injury first. That happens when blood flow returns after ischemia, like after cross-clamp removal.
Exactly. It seems counterintuitive, but restoring blood flow paradoxically triggers further damage. A key mechanism involves the mitochondria. When oxygen suddenly returns, they can generate a massive burst of reactive oxygen species ROS, or free radicals.
Oxidative stress.
Huge oxidative stress. These ROS damage cellular components, including membranes, proteins, and DNA. They can also destabilize those crucial calcium-handling proteins like YR2 and SIRCATA2, leading to calcium overload and dysfunction.
And clinically, this often manifests as low cardiac output syndrome, LCOS, after cardiac surgery.
Very commonly. That post-op myocardial dysfunction is often driven by this reperfusion injury cascade. Now, here's an interesting post-op pearl emerging from research.
Yeah.
There's growing evidence that continuing low-dose volatile anesthetic sedation or using dexmedetomidone in the early ICU period after cardiac surgery might actually reduce this reperfusion injury and subsequent LCOS.
How?
The proposed mechanisms include better mitochondrial stabilization, ongoing KATP channel activation, and continued blunting of detrimental catecholamine surges. It suggests our anesthetic choices can have protective effects extending well beyond the OR.
Fascinating. What about myocardial stunning? That's related, but slightly different, right? The heart muscle is viable, but just doesn't contract well for a while.
Right. Stunning is characterized by prolonged yet reversible contractile dysfunction after ischemia, even though blood flow is restored. Again, altered calcium handling seems key. Those RIR2 and SIRCA2 proteins we keep mentioning are often dysfunctional due to ischemia and ROS damage.
Leading to poor relaxation again.
Often, yes. Impaired relaxation diastolic dysfunction is a major feature of stunning. Even if the squeezed EF looks okay on echo, the ventricle is stiff and doesn't fill well. Patients can easily develop pulmonary edema if you give them too much fluid.
So the clinical action there.
Again, norepinephrine can be very helpful because it directly improves relaxation by boosting SIRCA2 activity. But the really crucial thing is avoiding aggressive fluid boluses. Use goal-directed fluid therapy, monitor filling pressures carefully, and don't overload that stunned, stiff ventricle.
And arrhythmias. Still a big post-op problem.
Huge. Post-op atrial fibrillation, POAF, is incredibly common after cardiac surgery. The mechanisms are complex, involving inflammation, autonomic imbalance, and structural changes. But on a cellular level, instability of those gap junctions, connexin 43 oxidation due to ROS, likely plays a role, disrupting coordinated electrical conduction in the atria.
Which is why we focus on prevention.
Exactly. Prophylaxis with magnesium, which helps stabilize membranes and channels. Continuing beta blockers, controlling rate and autonomic tone, and sometimes amiodarone loading are key strategies based on addressing those underlying cellular instabilities.
And we can't forget PRIS risk in the ICU either, right?
Definitely not. If a patient requires prolonged sedation post-op, the risk of PRIS with propofol accumulates. This is a major reason why alternative agents like midazolam or, increasingly, dexmedetomidine are often preferred for longer-term ICU sedation, especially in high-risk patients. It avoids that specific mitochondrial toxicity concern.
Can you give a final post-op vignette tying this together?
Sure. Picture that 68-year-old patient post-EVG-EF was only 25% pre-op. In the ICU, they're hypotensive, low cardiac index on the monitor. Check a quick echo. The LV squeeze isn't great, but the ventricle also looks stiff, not relaxing well.
So mixed picture.
Right. Just cranking up norepinephrine might raise the pressure, but could worsen diastolic function and oxygen demand. Giving lots of fluid would likely cause pulmonary edema. But understanding the cellular issues, likely stunning with impaired contractility and relaxation due to poor calcium handling, points you towards something like milrinone.
Because it helps both squeeze and relaxation.
Exactly. It provides inotropy, but also crucially enhances lusitropy, relaxation, by improving SIRCATA2A function. It addresses the specific cellular pathology contributing to the low output state. It's physiology-guided therapy.
That integration is really the key takeaway. So let's bring it all home. Pre-induction planning for that patient with known poor LV function. What are the absolute must-do practical steps based on this cell biology?
Okay, practical pearls. Get your invasive monitors in early, definitely in A-line. Consider PA catheter or T, depending on the case and severity. Induce slowly, carefully titrating your agents to effect. Avoid large, rapid boluses, especially of propofol. Maintain preload. Don't let them get dry, but don't overload either. And critically, anticipate the need for hemodynamic support. Have your vasopressors and inotropes drawn up and ready before you start. Assume they will become hypotensive.
Be prepared. And what are the major pitfalls we should constantly remind ourselves to avoid based on these cellular risks?
Three big ones jump out. First, avoid excessive or prolonged propofol in the ICU setting, especially in sick patients. Always keep Pris in the back of your mind. Second, don't aggressively fluid overload patients with known or suspected diastolic dysfunction. You'll cause pulmonary edema. Think diuretics or drugs that improve relaxation, not just more volume. Third, never, ever ignore electrolyte abnormalities. Low magnesium, low potassium, even abnormal calcium can directly trigger life-threatening arrhythmias by destabilizing ion channels. Check them, fix them aggressively. They're often preventable causes of major problems.
Powerful reminders. Okay, let's distill this entire deep dive into three crisp key takeaways for everyone listening.
All right, takeaway number one, modern anesthetic management has to integrate cellular biology. We're not just putting people to sleep, we're actively manipulating ion channels, calcium cycling, and mitochondrial function with our drugs. These are direct targets.
Got it. Cell biology isn't just theory.
Number two, the patient's underlying pathophysiology dictates everything. Heart failure, ARVC, ischemia. These conditions create specific cellular vulnerabilities that demand tailored anesthetic plans, specific drug choices, and targeted monitoring. One size does not fit all.
Tailor the plan to the cell.
And number three, vigilance and thoughtful drug selection aren't just for the OR. They must extend across the entire perioperative journey, pre-op optimization, intra-op management, and crucially into the ICU recovery phase to truly minimize complications related to cardiomyocyte dysfunction. It's a continuum of care.
That's excellent. It really emphasizes thinking long-term about cellular effects, which leads to maybe a final provocative thought. You mentioned the potential for a continued volatile use in the ICU for cardioprotection. That really pushes us to think about the long game, doesn't it? Beyond just getting through the case.
It does. It makes us question if some of our standard practices, like switching immediately away from volatiles post-op, might be missing an opportunity. Could maintaining some of those cellular protective mechanisms offered by volatiles or dexmedetomidine during that vulnerable early recovery phase actually improve long-term myocardial recovery? It's an area where we still have a lot to learn, but it definitely challenges us to think about cellular recovery, not just immediate hemodynamic stability.
Food for thought, indeed. Thinking about the cell long after the surgery is done.
Precisely.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.